Hello, and welcome to the University Guy podcast. I'm David Hawkins, an independent college counsellor in England. In this episode, I'm lucky enough to talk about one of the most innovative and disruptive recent entrants to the world of international higher education admissions, and to discuss the role that technology and access play in our world. So on this episode, I'm really delighted to talk to someone who's made a similar journey to me, actually, out of working sort of directly in the high school university sector into something ever so slightly different from that typical role. So Jen Dewar, thank you so much for your time.
David, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
So Jen, as I've hinted there, you're doing something slightly different to the norm in higher ed. So could you please tell us about your current role?
Of course. I work at Duolingo, which many of you probably know as a language learning app that you've downloaded onto your phones. Duolingo has about 300 million worldwide users learning more than 30 different languages for free. Duolingo started in 2011, and the mission of the company began as an endeavor to lower barriers for people all over the world in language learning. So to take away the high fees of language learning courses, to take away that, you know, people who want to learn foreign languages have to find teachers or tutors. And that's really the genesis of the language learning app of Duolingo. A few years ago, we realized that there were many people who had learned English for free on Duolingo who wanted to certify that they had learned English for free. They wanted to be able to get a job as a driver or at a hotel and show that they could work with, clients and guests who spoke English. And so they asked us, you know, could we tell them that they learned English through Duolingo, and they were certified to speak English. And you know, as we looked around the language assessment market, we realized that English language assessments were expensive and sometimes hard to access. And we felt like we were in a unique position to solve those challenges because we are a tech company, and we had, you know, millions of data points on how people learn languages that we were able to leverage to build the Duolingo English test. And that is my role at the company. I'm the head of strategic engagement for the Duolingo English test. And I just joined about 6 months ago, coming from a college admissions background, 17 years working at three different universities in international admissions. But I now at Duolingo, I'm responsible for both the sort of partnerships that we have with many of our U.S. university partners, institutions that are both highly selective and research universities, small liberal arts colleges, public flagship universities in the United States. And in addition to that, I'm also responsible for thinking about the different kinds of initiatives and engagements that we need to have at the Duolingo English test in order to become a test that really is a viable alternative to other English language assessment tests that are on the market. And so I work with, the Common Application, the Coalition Application. I work with different customer relations management software companies. I work with many different professional organizations. And right now, a lot of that is about raising the visibility and raising awareness of what we're doing with the Duolingo English test, because we are just starting our third admission cycle. So we are young and we are new. And it's important that people in the admissions and counseling ecosystem are aware of who we are and what we're doing, and that our mission is, in fact, to continue to lower barriers for students in the same way that the overall mission of Duolingo is to lower those barriers.
Great. And that's partly why we're speaking tonight, is having used Duolingo myself to try and learn a bit of Spanish and been aware of the test. Again, I think that the work you're doing is really great to make it easier for students to access the education that they want. So more power to your elbow, Jen.
Thank you. No, it's interesting. Our CEO at Duolingo, his name is Luis Von Ahn, and Luis is from Guatemala. And Luis applied to university in the United States from Guatemala in 1998. And when Luis applied to university, he had to fly to El Salvador to take an English language proficiency test. There were no test seats available in his home country of Guatemala. And his family was able to afford to send him to El Salvador. They were in a very fortunate position, but he realized, you know, when you look around, Guatemala is a very poor country, that he was in an incredibly unique position in the context of his country to be able to afford a plane ticket and the test fees to fly to El Salvador to take a test for admissions purposes. Luis then went and enrolled at Duke University, and he did his undergraduate study at Duke. And when he graduated, he got a PhD in computer science at Carnegie Mellon. And he's the inventor of reCAPTCHA. So when you type in, when you're maybe buying a ticket for a concert, when you type in all those sort of squiggly letters to prove that you're not a robot, he is the inventor of that program. He sold that to Google in his 20s. And after he sold reCAPTCHA to Google, he was able to really decide the trajectory of his life. You know, he didn't have any constraints on him that made him go one direction or the other. And he decided that it was going to be really important to sort of go back and think about where he came from and how he could take some of the challenges and issues that people in places like Guatemala face and address them with technology. And when we created the Duolingo English test, there were a few things that were really important to Luis. He wanted to mitigate the experience that he himself had. And so he wanted the test to not be expensive. So it's $49, the Duolingo English test. He wanted it to be accessible. And so the Duolingo English test is available on demand online anytime, anywhere in the world. It's taken via a computer that has an internet connection, a webcam, and a speaker and a microphone. So David, just like you and I are talking right now, is how you take the Duolingo English test. He wanted it to reflect what he came to understand and know was the more sort of rapid, fast-paced nature of college admissions. And so our results are available within 48 hours. He wanted it to be reflective of more than just a score for a student. And so we built in a video interview that we send to every institution. So not only do all of our institutions see the student's Duolingo English test score, but they also see the student responding to questions for 10 minutes. So they themselves can assess how well a student is speaking and reading and writing and responding to English. And they also sort of get a sense, and this is, I think, what I appreciate the most from my own admissions background, they get a sense of who the student is. They get a sense of their energy, their sort of essence. And, you know, David, you work directly with students, and I, for a long time, worked on the admission side. And there would sometimes be this disconnect when I would speak with a counselor who worked directly with a student and what we saw in the admissions process, you know, in that more two-dimensional distillation of the student. And I love that the Duolingo English test brings the student sort of to life. Literally, they're a video in front of you. You really get a sense of who they are. And so that's a little bit of what we're about. But I think the price point and the accessibility of the test is really, really important. And I hope that, you know, we work in English language proficiency. We are a language learning company at Duolingo. But I also hope that we serve as a model for all testing and how it can be delivered through technology less expensively and more accessibly. And it can make the path to higher education more accessible for students all over the world.
I can almost hear the counselors listening to this podcast around the world singing amen to hearing you say that, Jen.
Honestly, when I first started talking with, I didn't think I was going to leave admissions ever. You know, I have worked very hard to stay in admissions my whole career. I started in 2001 at Connecticut College, and I've been following my spouse around. He went and he's an academic, and he got a PhD, and I followed him to North Carolina, and I started working at Duke. And when he finally finished his training, we moved to St. Louis, and I, you know, very deliberately, we moved to St. Louis so that I could continue working in admissions. And I was working at Washington University in St. Louis, again, in, you know, doing international admissions. And I never imagined leaving admissions at, you know, this point in my career last year. But I just, you know, there were a series of events last fall with the ACT being canceled, with what's happening geopolitically in the United States in particular, and seeing for the first time since 9/11 trends of international students coming and wanting to study in the United States decreasing. And it just really brought sort of all together for me this idea that what we were doing was broken. And on the university side, we shouldn't sustain all of these barriers that we've been holding up for so long. And when I discovered the Duolingo English test, it was really the first solution. that I saw in my whole career that I felt like was implementable by universities, and really something that I felt like was viable and could change mobility for students. And so I appreciate the excitement and the enthusiasm from the counseling community. But I think as a very recent convert from the admissions community, we share that excitement as well and that hope for what we do and what we represent.
That's great. So you've hinted a little bit there, and if we delve back, I love to give people the chance to reflect and tell the stories. So you mentioned Connecticut College, and if we go back those X number of years that you mentioned, how did you get into working in international higher ed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was thinking about this as I was preparing to talk with you, David, today. So I grew up in eastern Massachusetts on a peninsula called Cape Cod, and it's a really isolated place. It's literally connected to the mainland by a bridge. And my parents are both public school teachers. And, you know, I hadn't had a lot of experiences traveling or meeting people different from myself when I was young. And I was very fortunate. I was an athlete, and I went away to undergraduate college. I went to Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I think sports was sort of what helped me understand that I could leave my small community and go somewhere else. And so I'm grateful for that experience of playing sports as a young person. And when I was in college, I spent my entire third year of university studying abroad in Bologna, Italy. And it was 1999 to 2000. I graduated from university in May of 2001. And that following fall, I started in admissions. And the experience that I had studying abroad in the year 1999 to 2000 was just wholly transformative for me. For somebody who had, you know, not had a lot of opportunity to travel, you know, had grown up in a very homogeneous place, to spend an entire year in Europe was incredible. And I look at that experience, and I know that that was sort of the beginning of the rest of my life in terms of the trajectory that I went on. But I think something else that happened right after I graduated from college that in many ways reinforced wanting to work in international education was September 11th. So, you know, I'm that generation. Yeah. I graduated from college, and a few months later, the towers fell, right? And the whole world changed. I think, you know, especially for us in the United States, because it was so close to home, literally. But also, I think, you know, the way that we viewed each other and safety and opportunity, it changed. And I looked back at that time, that was like a year and a half ago, you know, since I had left Europe, and it seemed like the world would never be the same again. And it felt like a real tragedy, and it felt like there had to be a way forward. If this was our new normal, which unfortunately I think we've all come to understand it is, you know, where the world has changed, that we would have to find a way to be able to move on together, and we would have to find a way to continue to learn from each other. And it just made me feel like the only path forward for all of us is to continue to bring people together, to continue to build communities where people can learn from each other, and to make education possible, more possible for more people. And I was fortunate at that time at Connecticut College that they needed some help on the international team. I remember the first few international applications that I read were from Turkey and Bulgaria. I just remember feeling really enchanted by the experience of reading these applications. And it really never stopped from there. And there have been so many experiences since then, David, for me, that I feel so grateful for, both on the road, but also because I worked at Duke and WashU and Connecticut College, all places that had resources for international students, we were able to bring students into those communities who came from backgrounds that were so so sorely underrepresented and so important to have in on campus and part of conversations. And you know, the experience of getting to build a community, it is in some ways very utopian, you know, to build these college communities. But you have to understand how transformative it can be for the students, you know, who are from, you know, the United States, who are studying on those campuses, but, you know, particularly for the students who come from all over the world to study on our campuses. And so it's really become, you know, my passion. It's become what I care about more than anything, is making sure that students have, you know, continued opportunity to meet each other and communicate and share and have mobility. And so I think it sort of all makes sense now. I'm grateful that you gave me the opportunity to think about this a little bit more reflectively than I normally do, David, because I'm really glad I ended up at Duolingo, because I think that this was sort of the next step in continuing to make education more possible for people.
Absolutely. I reflect myself quite often on the ability we have to do the work that is linking to the, you know, professions and the traditional two sides of it, being in a high school, being in a university, working as you and I do, slightly outside those fields, but still intimately linked with them, that we actually have a little bit more freedom and flexibility to pursue things which become those sort of pipe dreams a little bit when you have a day job and you have managers and you have targets you have to hit. So I agree with you that sometimes making a slight change enables you to stick to the mission that you want to be on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So delving back then, I'm fascinated by what I'm picking up is a trend that people have to do. You make that step from being a student to going into working in the admissions office. Had you done the whole tour guide thing, student help in admissions? Had you had any exposure to that kind of world before you took the job?
I had been a student helper in admissions, and I guess that goes back to the question of, like, why did I get into admissions? And I graduated from college, and I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And I thought that this would be, you know, an interesting 2-year endeavor, and then I would figure out the next step. And I fell into the probably minority category of people who end up, you know, doing this for much, much longer than 2 years. But it, you know, I knew that I liked the environment. I knew I wanted to be on a college campus. I cared about education, and I had come from this family of educators, although my parents sort of doing it in a much more traditional kind of sense. But it seemed like it made sense. And I didn't know, I think at the time, how much you can never know. But I didn't know how much I was going to learn and how much I was going to be exposed to, and how much it was going to push me in so many different ways. But I'm very, very grateful that I made that decision to go and work at Connecticut College. And that was a super place to be. You know, it was much more like my own undergraduate experience. A lovely small liberal arts college, right on the coast in New England. But a really strong commitment to international students. Like I said, we had international financial aid at the time. And I remember those decisions being so challenging because we had a limited budget. But because it was a small college, I think we got, as admissions officers, more exposed to all of the different roles in admissions office than you get when you work at a larger institution where you can be more siloed, because of the nature of the volume. You know, a place that has 5,000 applications versus 40,000 applications, you just get a broader view of everything when you have a smaller set to look at than when you move over to, you know, a place like Duke University, which is where I ended up next.
Yes, I mean, I can see that, certainly. I mean, given the sort of institutions you've worked at and the time frame over them, I'm really intrigued as to sort of trend things that change. I've been reflecting this myself with the news that came out recently that Beloit are no longer going to publish the mindset list. The sort of British sense of humour in me says, well, are we in 18 years' time going to have a mindset list that says the students entering college this year don't know what the mindset list is? It would be a lovely circular thing in it. But if you think back to, you say, you know, 9/11, dial-up internet, can't think who would have been in, you know, in the top of the charts and celebrities and things. But that's a, you know, a generation of kids going through high school, in effect. You know, over the time you've been working in this field, what particular changes would you say stand out?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the everyday use of technology has changed our work so much. And I guess for me, that was part of the reminder that we have, technology has already influenced the work we do in admissions and counseling, and it will continue to influence the work we do. And ultimately, the roads are leading to using it more than less. And that made me feel more reassured that eventually the university world will be ready for a test that right now I think still looks really different and foreign to them because of the way that we deliver our testing. Mm-hmm. So certainly technology has changed. But David, you know, when I started at Duke in 2003, I think we got less than 100 applications from China. And, you know, when I left, we were getting, you know, more than 1,500. When I left WashU, more than 2,000 applications from China. The economy has changed in the world, you know, where people have resources to pay $70,000 a year for an undergraduate education has changed. And those shifts are all represented in our applicant pools and in the students that we enroll. You know, parts of the world that used to be better represented are not as well represented now, too. You know, places like Japan, Pakistan, not as well represented on our campuses as they were at the beginning of my admissions career and predating my admissions career. And so there's been a lot of demographic shifts. But I think for those of us that work in international education, you know, our work, I think, at the beginning of my career was much more like a sort of a side shop next to the main admissions office. Yeah. And we've become so much more integrated because international students tend to make up so much more of a class at any given university than they used to. And I think, you know, the whole admissions office has had to find a way to not accommodate, but just build into their work processes and workflow international applications as well. And you know, I think a lot of how we've been able to do that in admissions is also using technology and not having, you know, a separate file room for paper files for international versus domestic files.
Yes. I mean, I think a sort of reflection of that is just, I think in the last year or so, people of sort of your and I's standing and experience in the profession hitting a point, which my sense is maybe 20 years ago, you're running international missions and that's where you stop.
Yeah.
Now people transitioning to running the entire enrollment departments of certain colleges, and actually having that international experience is no longer the barrier. In fact, it's almost essential to be able to do the whole part of the picture. So I agree with what you're saying about increasingly how important it is to have a really good handle on the demographics and numbers and things. And to hear you say some of the numbers about how things have changed really puts it into quite stark perspective.
Right. And I guess the other thing I would say is culturally there have been some real changes, and I think those have been most recent. But, you know, David, you and I are both parents and you know, can share the experience of being a working parent in this field. There was a time in very early on in my time working in admissions and probably until 5 or 6 years ago, I would say, where there was such a disproportionate representation of women in admissions leadership. And you know, women have tended to make up the majority of admissions officers at U.S. institutions, but they weren't well represented at the leadership level. And especially those who were parents, and especially, you know, even men who may have been primary caretakers of their children. And I do think that we as a community have become more aware of that challenge for professionals and have become more supportive of that challenge for professionals. But that is something that I think we continue to need to do work with, because we, by not, you know, supporting that group very well, are losing professionals who, you know, enrich our work and who bring value and diversity. And so I do see the field diversifying at the leadership level, not just in, you know, women and people who are parents and primary caretakers, but also in, you know, people from underrepresented backgrounds. And that's been very encouraging to see, but we still, you know, are just starting to move the needle in that direction.
Absolutely. Well, you touch a button there that's very close to my heart, as you know, and listeners to the podcast, you know about my passion for making the profession more family friendly. I can say, watch this space. There are a couple of emails sitting in my inbox now of some exciting projects. So thank you for reminding me, Jen, of more work I have to do.
No, I've always admired that about you, David. You know, I had my daughter in 2009, and I was too overwhelmed for the first couple of years to even talk about this, like, publicly. But the first time that I did a session about this was in 2012, when it was still OACAC in Denver. And the session was called, "Ouch, I Just Bumped My Head." Yeah. but it was amazing to me that, you know, this was only 6 years ago. And this was not something that we were really talking about. You know, at a sort of general level at conferences. It was like people sort of whispering in the corners about the challenges that they were facing. But now you go to an international ACAC conference and there's maybe a half dozen different kinds of sessions about, you know, being a working parent or being an underrepresented person who is trying to break through the ranks, or being a woman who's trying to crash through the glass ceiling. And it's really encouraging to see our community sort of embracing that it's important to have people from all kinds of backgrounds and perspectives at the leadership level, because that's really where the thought leaders are. And that's where change comes culturally, is, you know, from the top down. It's not so much a bottom up profession.
Absolutely. Great. Given all of this and given everything we've talked about and the experience you've had, this is kind of a question which seems a little trite, given that I think I probably ended up hanging out with you in at least four or five different cities around the world, because it's the nature of our profession. But in a profession that does enable us lots of exciting opportunities, could you pick out one particular highlight over your career thus far?
Oh my gosh. I think it's actually one of the things that I've done most recently. And so, you know, like so many of the wonderful admissions professionals that you've had on your podcast, you know, I've gotten to visit dozens of countries and I've interacted with thousands and thousands of students, and some of whom I've remained in touch with, and you know, just followed their trajectories. And I do think this work gets better as it goes on, because this, as the students that you know interacted with when they were in high school in 2005, as you know, as they enroll at your institution and they graduate and they go on and they get, you know, they start their careers or they get graduate degrees and eventually, you know, start their own families and sort of live their lives. It's just so fulfilling to see where they end up and what they're doing. And so I always feel like this just gets better. But last April, so right after I joined Duolingo, I went to the Indaba, the Hali Access Network Indaba, yeah. In Kenya. And the Hali Access Network is, Hali stands for High Achieving Low Income. And the network was started by some folks in the United States at the university side, and also some very committed folks who worked with some community-based organizations and schools in Africa that were primarily supporting high-achieving, low-income students. And this group has now grown to over 30 different organizations that span the African continent, supporting thousands of high-achieving, low-income students from probably 20 or so different countries, mostly sub-Saharan African countries. And they get together every year and they talk about some of the challenges that that particular population of students face in terms of accessing education, in terms of accessing financial aid, in terms of the support networks that exist in their home communities, as these students oftentimes return to their communities and, you know, become change agents in their home countries. And I had never gone to this conference before, but I went because Duolingo has established a partnership with the Hali Access Network where we're providing the Duolingo English test to all of their students for free. So I went to sort of launch this initiative, and it's very small. You know, there were about 35 of us there, and we spent 3 days sitting in a room talking about all of the issues related to students who are part of this access network. And it was just incredible, David, to be with, you know, people who live in places like Somaliland, you know, and work at schools where, you know, they have no government support. They're working in a place, in a country that's not even a recognized country. Yeah. And they're supporting men and women in that country in their path to education. And, you know, just sort of unpacking all of the challenges related to this. And it was really one of the most extraordinary experiences of my life, and one of the most moving experiences, I think, that I've had since starting to work in admissions. And so that, I think, is the highlight thus far. But, you know, we're fortunate because the highlight reel is long, David.
Absolutely.
it is long. But I do think that that's where I end up most recently.
Well, I think it's great that you highlight access again in there. I think it's something that increasingly, as we do this work, becomes fundamentally important, that it's not just the right to an education, but the opportunities that come with it. And you know, I constantly use the term, I'm not sure exactly whether it was Donald Rumsfeld who coined it or he copied someone else, but people, you don't know what you don't know. and being able to connect people so they can not only realize that there's a bit that they don't know, but it's even open to them that there's a question they hadn't even thought of asking, I think it's hugely powerful. And I think that connects all of us who do this work.
I think so too. And it's also, I think, when I was at the Indaba, I realized that there's so much that we can do. We just have to decide that we want to do it. And a lot of that is just being exposed. When I worked in admissions, I'm embarrassed to tell you, but I didn't even know how much standardized tests cost for international students. I if you would ask me how much a traditional English language proficiency test cost, I'd say, I don't know, maybe $100, which is a lot. And I recognize that was a lot in a country like Togo, but it costs $280 in Togo, and that was something I just wasn't aware of. And I wasn't aware that if you live in Burundi, you have to take a 12-hour bus ride to Rwanda to take the test that most admissions offices require. And to think about what's required of those students who have to take a 12-hour bus ride and then, you know, sleep on the floor of a hostel or a relative's home before they go in and sit for a test. And it just sort of brought it all in front of me. And it made me realize, like, we have the opportunity to change this. We have the ability to do it now. We didn't until recently, but we have these technologies. And if we can all sort of decide that we want to leverage them and we actually want change, it could be absolutely transformative for so many students all over the world.
Jen, I think that's a really great message to leave it with. As you've heard you talk over the last half hour and recount not only your background, but what Duolingo have been doing in the past and with you now involved, what you hope to do in the future. It's really inspiring. So thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for your time in chatting to me.
Thank you, David. It's nice to talk with you.
The work that Jen and her colleagues are doing is of great interest to me. And with continued issues across the globe around access to the standardized tests needed for university admissions, primarily to the United States, the work that Duolingo are doing is to be greatly admired. That's it for this episode. For more information, please follow me on Twitter at UniGuyDavid and subscribe to the podcast via Spotify and Buzzsprout. To get in touch with anything to do with my college counselling services and to learn more about the team I work with at Syzygy Global Education, please email me via david@hawkinsglobaleducation.co.uk. Thanks for listening.